You're with Andrew West here on the Religion and Ethics Report. Not in Sydney this week, not at the G20, or not exactly at the G20, just a few kilometres down the road on the Gold Coast, where a group of academics and scholars and activists are meeting for, if you like, an R20, a religion G20, looking at the connections specifically between religion, religious freedom, and the economy. And with me is Professor Brian Grimm. Brian is president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. He was for a long time at Georgetown University. Brian, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
And I also have with me Professor Ram Kanaan, who is a professor and director of the Program for Religion and Social Policy Research at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Professor.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Brian, coming out of the G20, we had a proposal for 2% economic growth. It was related to the idea of business paying its taxes, playing by the rules. You've looked at another area that people might not automatically associate with prosperity and business success, and that is religious freedom. How does religious freedom relate to prosperity?
Well, it relates in two ways. First, where there's a lack of religious freedom, you have more religious conflict and turmoil. So rather than religious freedom being a detriment to a stable environment, it promotes a stable environment, and that's a fundamental condition for business. The other way that it relates is that when you have religious freedom, all members of society feel free to contribute. So therefore, you have innovative ideas coming from religious minorities as well as majorities. But minorities are particularly important because they have this desire to fit in and survive and struggle. They're beginning often at the bottom, and that's where a lot of innovation happens, and that's where the next generation of business might come from.
I found some very interesting statistics in Iraq that may be at the root of even the latest outbreak of violence, appalling violence, and it didn't relate so much to intercommunal violence.
There was a survey done by the Pew Research Center in 2012, the year before ISIS started to make its move into Iraq. And what they found was that of the five chief concerns that the Iraqi public had, religious group conflict, ethnic conflict were on the bottom, but corruption, crime, and number one concern was unemployment.
Yeah, 74-75%.
That's right. So the overwhelming majority of people saw that as the key national problem. And they weren't the only ones that noticed that. ISIS, which was based in Syria at the point, also noticed that people didn't have jobs. They were looking for opportunity, new meaning, and they came in and said, that's an opportunity for us to fill the void. Imagine what had happened if businesses and leaders of the world had also seen that unemployment as an opportunity to prevent terrorism. We might see a very different situation today.
So is your argument or your impression that this kind of economic privation, this kind of economic instability only feeds these sectarian tensions? And that if you solve the economics, you can breach the religious tension? Or is it the other way around?
It's both ways. So, I mean, when you have, when you lack religious freedom and you have a religiously repressive environment coming either from the government or from groups in society, that destabilizes the situation. So in those cases, reversing that religious discrimination would have a great effect in producing a stable environment for business and economies to flourish and jobs and good jobs to be created.
Now, you've said that business is at the historic crossroads of or commerce, if not the modern corporation, then certainly commerce and trading is at the crossroads of culture and religion.
Yeah, it's at the crossroads of creativity. Giving an example from Australia, if I can, you know, it's a country that has a great respect for religious freedom, and that has promoted religious minorities to be able to thrive. And one great example is sanitation. You know, the large cereal company, maybe many people don't know that that's owned by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, a Protestant denomination. So by having religious freedom, this minority group was able to thrive and flourish, and their motivation for the business is health and well-being, and they see that both as physical but also spiritual well-being. Very interesting, when you open up society for all religious groups to participate, you see this kind of innovation coming from unexpected corners.
And companies that overlook the notion of religious pluralism, they can suffer. Now, you cited a very popular American fashion label. What are we talking about there? Because it's quite a profound example.
Yeah, well, there was a young woman who interviewed for a job as a store clerk at Abercrombie & Fitch, the clothing retailer internationally but based in the U.S., and she interviewed in a headscarf. She's a Muslim girl in the United States, and she was given the job. But then when she showed up for work in her headscarf, they said, "You can't wear that here. That's against our dress code. You're fired." And they fired her, and then that case went to court. They lost the case on religious freedom discrimination grounds, and then it went to a higher court. They lost it again, and now it's been taken to the Supreme Court as an example case, and their stocks dropped precipitously once that was announced. So that, you know, is a sign of the cost of denying freedom. The benefit of freedom provided can be great.
And in the United States, you put a figure of something like one-third of Americans, one-third suffer religious discrimination in the workplace. That seems awfully high. Must be a very broad definition, Brian.
Well, it was more than a third, actually, 36% according to a national survey. What they did, they asked, have you either experienced or witnessed religious discrimination in the workplace? So it doesn't mean that one-third personally experienced it, but at least one-third of workers in the U.S. Saw this. So this could be like the Abercrombie & Fitch, someone being fired because of their religious faith. And this doesn't happen only for Muslims wearing headscarves. Even, you know, Christians in schools who may be a little bit too outspoken about their faith can be asked to leave. Mm-hmm. We've seen the workplace become less faith-friendly. You know, how can that be good for business? It may be some of your best employees may be very religious, and you don't want to lose them by discriminating against their faith.
Professor Ram Kanan, we've talked with Brian about those big companies, Abercrombie and Fitch, for example. We'll talk about Coca-Cola in a moment. In your research, you looked at the very grassroots relationship between economics and religion. Now, what did you look at?
I was interested in congregation, where people go to worship, usually on a weekly basis. We found in the United States that this is the most prevalent community organization, spread over every city, every county. So I was interested to say, okay, we have congregation that in our culture get zero money from the government. I was interested to know how much do they really contribute to the community, but not just in good stories, not just in we help a homeless family move here. I wanted to assess the dollar value of one religious congregation, an average religious congregation, to its local economy.
So very hard data, going beyond the feel-good factor.
Exactly. We interview 100 congregations in three cities, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Fort Worth, Texas. We visited them and spent with them at least 6 hours each. And we ask them about the budget, the activities, the people that come, the contribution to nature, the contribution to people. And we assessed all of it in dollar terms. What we found was that there are many ways of measuring it, but the range of value of an average congregation contribution to the local economy ranged between $1.3 million to $2.6 million.
This is just one religious congregation.
An average one.
An average. It's putting back between 1.3 and 2.6 million.
Correct. We also found that those 100 congregations, for example, produce over 1,000 positions, and only 16% of them were clergy, meaning they can support over 900 positions of people who are employed in those communities. They pay the salaries, they pay the benefit, and of course they pay the taxes.
So what sort of jobs are we talking about? Teachers or cooks or cleaners or...
Teachers, music directors, singer, professionals, social worker, community activist, bookkeeper, secretaries, and custodians.
So these are non-profit organizations, and yet they're having this enormous economic impact.
Exactly. Not only they're influencing, is they're taking the money from their own members. So it's like a communal pot. If you're a member, they say, whatever you can pay, you pay. Mm. From this money, they actually contributed to the economic vitality of the community. They also support many of the local businesses. People don't look at it that way. But most congregations order flowers every weekend. They pay for a contractor to fix the building, heating, cooling, maintenance. All is being done by employing local contractors.
And the other interesting thing that you mentioned was that these faith communities, unlike big for-profit industries, are willing to invest in downtowns, in inner cities. In America, as we know, over the past 30, 40 years, there's been that hollowing out, businesses going to business parks in the suburbs, but not faith communities.
Not only they are the last one to stay in the city, they're located in many areas that no other organization would like to be there. We did a mapping of congregation versus other nonprofit. Nonprofit, not only profit. Mm-hmm. Most nonprofit like to be in center city on our major highways. Congregation are everywhere. You cannot go more than 1/4 mile in Philadelphia without seeing one congregation. Any community, we correlated it with all the index of crime, poverty. They are the one who stick and stay in the worst communities, in the most devastated places, and they stay the longest. Mm. You look schools, they leave earlier. You look supermarket, they leave earlier. Congregation stay the longer.
We saw that in New Orleans after the cyclone. It was the religious communities that were there as the foundation, the building blocks for renewing that city.
After Hurricane Katrina, what we found is the government sent their forces and they failed. Then they made a contract with a big corporation and they failed. Churches, local churches and faraway churches, were the one that provide the most help for rehabilitation and restoration. So much so that the General Accounting Office, which is a government unit, when assessed everything, said they are so good, maybe we should compensate them so next time we can rely on them to provide those services.
Brian Grimm, you have a story about business, if you like, breaching international borders or reaching across international borders. And it is, of course, the very fraught tension between India and Pakistan. And it's a story that involves a multinational.
When you think of religion and hot topics, you can't get any hotter than Pakistan and India. You know, a nation that used to be one, but divided across now with barbed wire, Muslim North, Hindu majority, India in the South. So, you know, why would a company want to wade into that territory? You know, don't you want to stay as far away from these religious and, you know, political tensions as possible? Well, one company saw that trying to bridge these interfaith, intercultural tensions is actually good for business and good for people. And it was Coca-Cola. So they began looking at the market. If they start marketing Coke as a Pakistani drink, well, Indians won't want to drink it. Or as an Indian drink, Pakistanis won't want to drink it. They'll shift to another company. So they put their heads together and they said, we need to have an advertising campaign that brings everybody together. So they developed what they called small world Coke machines that had a video screen, totally new technology. You know, they had to invest heavily into this so that when you walked up to the Coke machine in India, on the other side coming at you were people coming up to a Coke machine in Pakistan. It was as if you were just walking right up to someone else, only divided by glass.
You're not an apostle of Coke. I know that's the point. That's right. But there is a downside, though, to that, isn't there, Brian, in this sense that one of the things that is considered something of a contributor to tension today is globalization. The idea that the big multinational corporation is displacing the small local stallholder. It's a two-edged sword. I mean, you've brought out the idea of Coke breaching this international boundary, but at the same time, the Coke machine could displace the little local kiosk seller who sells the locally bottled Coke.
It's always a tension. And, you know, in looking at this issue, there's good and bad in everything. So there's good and bad in the local vendor who may not be efficient in what they're doing. So even if a local vendor's there, there's things that need to be done to help make them more efficient. And I think some of the thinking of multinationals is moving in that direction. I can give an example from BMW, another multinational corporation, but they've realized that interfaith, intercultural understanding is essential for their own business success, and they've been trying to incentivize that among small entrepreneurial national organizations, and every year they give out 10 prizes for small companies that are helping to bridge these divides. So I think in the multinationals, there's, you know, sometimes very valid criticism, but some of them, like the BMW group, is recognizing that they have to share their experience and understanding of bringing the world together through business so it can happen at the national, international, or even very local level.
What would you both be saying to the G20 leaders who have talked about things not strictly on the G20 agenda, like Syria and Iraq, climate change? What would you say to them about religion?
I just came back from the World Economic Forum in Dubai, and I'm on the role of Faith Council, and we had people coming from the Ebola working group saying, help, you know, we find that religious communities are making the biggest difference, more than any multinational effort. So what I would say is that if you ignore the role of faith in business, in peace, in health, you're missing perhaps one of the most innovative drivers of jobs and economic development.
Professor Nan?
I would say that people trust the religious leader more than they trust the political leaders. And if you allow people the freedom of religion and the ability to congregate and meet religiously, then you can work with clergy and open the mind and open the doors for politicians to achieve much more harmony in society. When you have freedom of religion, when you have religion organization, and you work with clergy, you can achieve and build a lot in society.
Professor Ram Kanan of the University of Pennsylvania and Dr. Brian Grimm of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, I thank you both for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Great to be with
Pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
And that's where we'll leave this edition of the program, which this week came to you from the Gold Coast, where religious leaders and scholars and politicians have been meeting for the G20 Interfaith Summit. The hope is that there will be an interfaith summit after every G20 in the country where it's hosted. In the next few weeks, we'll bring you some more voices from this summit, including that of a very feisty opposition MP from Turkey. He warns that President Erdogan is turning into a new sultan. But for now, you can go online at the RN website to download or share this program or leave a comment. Thanks as always to our producer, Scott Spark, and this week, a special thanks to executive producer Jane Jeffs and to technical producer Lila Schunner. I'm Andrew West. See you next week.